Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to spend the next hour talking with one of the smartest, most, I think, impactful, and certainly most courageous of men I've had the privilege of knowing. His name is Brigadier General Robert Spalding, United States Air Force retired. He is these days the president and the driving force behind a remarkable new startup called Semper. And we're going to talk with him about what Semper is doing and why it is so important. But we're also going to talk with him about something that he is arguably among the most knowledgeable about in our country. Certainly, I would say, among those in the military community. And that is the Chinese Communist Party, its true character, its ambitions, and the state of the threat that it poses to us. That will be the topic for, the next five segments. Let me just say that General Spalding brings to this not only a PhD, but a wealth of experience in uniform as a B-2 pilot, as a former defense attaché in Beijing, and as a strategist for President Trump on the National Security Council, in addition to a variety of posts in uniform. We're delighted to have him with us always, but especially at a time such as this. General Spalding, welcome back, sir. It's a privilege to have you with us.
Great to be back. Thank you.
I want to start, if I may, sir, by just asking you to sort of level set for us on the character of the Chinese Communist Party as you see it and the magnitude of the danger we are facing from it at the moment.
Well, I mean, I think there's something we have to acknowledge, and I would rather point to Putin as an example of what I'm getting ready to say, but quite well how many people were predicting that Putin was not going to invade Ukraine. It was almost unanimous. And I had heard all sorts of, reasons why they wouldn't invade Ukraine. And yet when people asked me prior to the invasion, is Putin going to invade? I said, absolutely. And the issue is that we tend to mirror image these leaders of authoritarian regimes, and we don't actually try very hard. And that's something I believe is tied to our arrogance. We don't try very hard to get in the minds of these leaders and how they might make decisions or why they might make decisions. And I think this is the case with Xi Jinping. We don't do enough work to get inside his head and try to essentially look at the world through his eyes and then begin to understand what he wants, what he might do, and then ultimately prepare ourselves for what those might be. And I think that's the issue that we're faced with. And Xi Jinping he's leading a regime that's far different than Russia. But in terms of our ability to protect the things that he might do, I think it's about the same as it is with Russia. And so we need to recognize that he's going to make some decisions. They might seem crazy to us. They might seem counter to anything the economists would say about, how this might impact the Chinese economy or the global economy. And we have to recognize that Xi Jinping has a different set of calculus, and it has more to do with, what he wants as opposed to what we think is best for the world.
Amen. That's especially true. And you'd think this is just, obvious to everybody. And yet, as you say, it's not, especially to those in the elites in our country who constantly are telling us otherwise. But it's especially true that we should be thinking more like Xi Jinping does, as we should have about Putin on the eve of the invasion, because Xi Jinping was clearly greenlighting that invasion, you know, in their no limits partnership. So there's a different calculus operating for sure. And General, in my brief introduction to you, I did not note that you are the author of two really important books that I think have tried to bring to the fore some of that thinking, not least from your experience in Beijing, intimately observing these guys as well as elsewhere. Stealth War is the title of the first, and War Without Rules is the title of the second. And as we're speaking, I'm very pleased to say it has just been translated, War Without Rules, that is, into Korean. And we'll be talking a bit about why that's an important audience for some of these insights and recommendations that you've made. So, General, in terms of the way the Chinese think, and Xi at the top of that power structure, of course, there is a practice that you have been, again, talking about. I think War Without Rules is all about it. Unrestricted warfare is the term that the Chinese have used, specifically to then senior colonels who went on, like you, to become general officers. Tell us a little bit about what unrestricted warfare is in the hands of the Chinese and the harm that it's done to us, having been subjected to it now for decades.
Well, I think it starts with understanding what the Chinese Communist Party is. As Xi Jinping himself says, it's a Marxist-Leninist regime. And he actually believes in Marxism and Leninism as the way that a country should organize its social, political, and cultural institutions. He believes it through his core. And, you know, I might add that if you remember the quote from Forrest Gump, "I'm not a smart man," he's not a smart man. But he has somebody now on the standing Politburo that has been advising not only Xi Jinping, but Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao before him in Wang Huning. And Wang Huning wrote a very important book called America versus America. In Chinese, it's Meguo Dui Meguo. And what that book talked about is the social and cultural decline of the United States. And especially what he brought out in that book was this idea that the Chinese Communist Party had to deal with social and cultural decline of China as a result of modernity. Globalization, the internet was going to bring in these things that would tend to you know, bring in bad ideas for the Chinese people, and that they needed to get a hold of that. And so when you understand what
Sir, could I just interrupt you for 1 second on this get a hold of it point? Is it not the case that they have, with their support for entities inside the United States and individuals, of course, but also their cultural Marxist doctrine, been not just getting a hold of it, but very aggressively promoting this kind of division and fracturing of our country?
Right. And I think this is something, I mean, you bring up a really good point. Let's take a step back here just for a second, and let's we're in a second Cold War here. So let's just go back to the first Cold War. The things that the Soviet Union sought to do to the United States and the rest of the free world are really no different. And again, China is a Marxist-Leninist regime, as was the Soviet Union. Their ability to do that within the free states, United States, Western Europe, you know, the free countries of Asia and other places, was moderated by the fact that we didn't have globalization. They weren't connected to global economy in any real way, and we didn't have the internet.
Hold the thought, sir. We're going to come back to the retrospective on the Cold War and how it applies to the war we're in today, right after this with more, with General Rob Spalding. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Former President Donald Trump has been indicted again. This time, he and 18 others have been accused of racketeering for challenging the legitimacy of the 2020 election and seeking redress. At the core of this Trump indictment, among others, is the proposition that those who contend that election was stolen are perpetrating a completely unfounded big lie. Prosecutors are asserting that at least in some instances, the effort to prove otherwise was actually criminal. Yet, new revelations show officials have known for nearly 3 years about evidence of, quote, widespread voter fraud, unquote, in Michigan via an apparently well-organized effort by a Biden-connected group called GBI Strategies. It evidently operated in other states as well. Will the truth about these and many other 2020 election irregularities be on trial, or just the targets of obvious political warfare against Donald Trump and his team? This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and we're continuing a very important conversation with General Robert Spalding, United States Air Force retired, top, strategic thinker, as well as national security practitioner, and a man that we are privileged to recognize, among other things, as not only a great military leader, an author, including of Stealth War and War Without Rules, and not least as a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, which I'm very proud. General, I had to interrupt you due to the hard break, but you were making the point that during the Cold War with the Soviet Union, the aspirations were very similar to those of the Chinese Communist Party, but the opportunities for the Soviets to pursue our destruction through unrestricted warfare techniques, I guess it might be said, was not present as it is today. If you carry on with that thought, sir.
Right. And if you remember, Frank, back then they called them active measures. And so, I mean, obviously they tried them, but there was no internet. There was no globalization. Another key tenet of the doctrine with which we used to win the first Cold War was this idea of the offensive. And the United States played that beautifully. It was started by Eisenhower, and it was this idea that we would rather than trying to meet the Soviets with conventional military power, we would focus on nuclear weapons. We would focus on the offensive, and then we would use that to deter conflict. Importantly, because we wanted to use the power of the U.S. economy, the power of the U.S. political system, the power of U.S. society, the technology, talent, and capital that comes from free people working in tandem with our allies and partners to show the world the best way to organize socially, culturally, politically is the way that we are organized. And that was successful to a T. Now, what the Chinese did was they studied that. So they were nowhere near the Soviet Union in terms of providing global impact, but they had the same boldness. They had a vision for doing the exact same thing, except they watched, they learned, they listened, and they created a doctrine, and it's really well laid out in unrestricted warfare. It's a warfare doctrine, but instead of like the Cold War, which was based on offensive nuclear weapons and really growing the economy, What they built was a defensive doctrine based on protecting their society from the infiltration of ideology while still enabling them to take the technology, talent, and capital from the West to build their economic and military might. And that's what they've done. And so when we look today at unrestricted warfare, you bring up a good point. They're in things like the algorithms of ByteDance that are used to take all the data that comes from the TV that watches you, TikTok, learn about you, and then turn around and return content that is meant to begin to change your intentions, your perceptions, your behaviors. Okay, so that's what they're doing on the internet, not just through ByteDance, but many other capabilities, both using people and using technology. And so what, but they can do that because they adopted a defensive doctrine in the very beginning. They created the Great Firewall. They went to great lengths to make sure that they controlled the narrative that was going to the Chinese people before they ever thought about really going out and aggressively being offensive. And I think that's the thing that we failed to learn. We failed to learn that in the globalized internet-connected world, not protecting the social, cultural, and political and economic aspects of your country is really what unrestricted warfare is all about. Now, from this bastion of defensive maneuvers that they've created, they're free to attack the global system and undermine the social, the political, the cultural, the economic, the financial institutions that made that so powerful during the first Cold War. And the, our biggest problem in Washington, D.C. is we cannot go on the defensive.
Go on the defensive. Let me just be the devil's advocate here, General, because I part of that Cold War story that I think you didn't speak to directly, and I'd encourage you to do so, where things really went offensive on our part, it seems to me, was when President Reagan mapped out a strategy for not just what we had been doing, you know, for I guess three presidencies before he came to office, namely, well, I call it appeasement, the fancy term for it, the French was détente, or even containment, which I think is what most, really even going back to the Eisenhower years, most of the U.S. governments prior to Reagan sought. But he actually wanted, as he said, to bring down the evil empire, to put it on the ash heap of history, to implement a strategy he famously called "We Win, They Lose," which was a kind of unrestricted warfare against the Soviets, wasn't it? It used economic power, it used technology, it used financial means to cut off their life support, as well as to build up our military. You served in it with great distinction as a deterrent, and the rest, as they say, is history. And then today, it seems to me what we're dealing with in terms of the Chinese, you're absolutely right. They wanted to create kind of a bastion within their, you know, communist empire. But they were also simultaneously, I would argue, using that unrestricted warfare in very much an offensive way, going back prior to when that book was published in 1999, I think. Are we saying the same thing, just differently, or are we at odds?
No. I mean, because Reagan had a society that was already protected from the influence of the Soviet Union. We decoupled. We had COCOM. We had numerous laws and regulations and rules about what companies could do business with the Soviet Union and how we did trade with the Soviet Union. Those were in place when Reagan came in. So he could go on the offensive, particularly with things like U.S. Information Agency and technology. But we had an industrial base that we had invested in. We had invested in science and technology. We had done a lot of things. And so he could step in and take the tools and then begin to go offensive. What I'm telling you is today, we cannot go offensive because we can't reach the scale of China. The most important thing we have to do is protect our population, protect the social, cultural, political, and economic integrity of our society. Then we can go on the offensive. We haven't built the framework that Reagan was able to adopt when he came into office.
Very good point. And the extent to which the Chinese have actually penetrated our country, in addition to the captured elite, as they like to call it, that is exercising malign influence, I think, on their behalf, really. But they're also inside our wire, as they say in the military, in innumerable ways. And I guess that really speaks to your point that we're not in any position to, well, defend ourselves, let alone be on offense as we need to be vis-a-vis this Chinese threat. We're going to have to take a break in a minute, but just your quick thoughts on what kinds of correctives are needed to get us properly defended here at home.
You know, it's really simple. You know, it's not hard to implement. It's going to be painful, but we have to decouple. You know, you have the Raytheon CEO saying it is impossible for the United States to decouple from China. This is a company that provides a lot of the weapon systems that the U.S. military uses. And he's saying that we need the Chinese for our weapons. I mean, this is the extent of the madness that we've gone into in our industrial base. And I cannot tell you how frustrating it is to hear Americans say to ourselves that something like building our industrial base is impossible. I mean, we used to think putting a man on the moon was impossible, but we did it. We used to think splitting an atom was impossible, but we did it. And now we're saying we can't rebuild our industrial base, that it's impossible.
Yeah.
I mean,
General, we're going to have to drill down on that intensively on the other side of a short break, and especially talk a little bit about what you're trying to do in that regard. But the idea, especially that we're relying for anything in our weaponry, our military capabilities on Chinese sources of supply is indeed, as you say, madness. We'll be right back with more with General Rob Spalding right after this. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. I hope you're finding this as fascinating as I do. This is a short course on the challenge of our time, the Chinese Communist Party, and what we better be doing about it, taught by one of our country's preeminent thinkers on these matters, a man who has not just been thinking about them and talking about them, warning about them, but has actually put his life on the line to protect us against this and other similar threats. And General Spalding, you were just describing, you know, the kinds of things that we've got to be about, like rebuilding our industrial base and capabilities. And I know this is something that, again, you're not just talking the talk, you're walking the walk with your company Semper. And I want you to talk a little bit about that and how it fits in the digital infrastructure space, particularly to that rebuilding. But just, if you would, start with how have we gotten into the fix we're in terms of these supply chain dependencies, in terms of the hollowing out of our industrial capabilities? And according to two really important studies, one out of Australia, one out of the American Enterprise Institute here, you know, we've really let them run the table on technologies that are going to be decisive to both future commercial as well as military competitiveness.
Well, I think the real challenge here is that we thought we could do the thinking and they could do the building. And their intent was, let's do the building for the Americans until we can do the thinking. Then we'll have all the capacity to do the building and the thinking. And that's how we won the first Cold War. That's how we won two world wars, is really our industrial base, our our economic productivity. And we basically wiped that out here in the United States. And so when I hear a CEO of a major company saying that, you know, it's impossible, I feels like that we've basically given up, like we've capitulated already. And what we have to do, really, and as we have an enormous opportunity to do that.
That CEO runs one of our preeminent military industrial enterprises, Raytheon. I mean, so this is not just a guy who's trying to sell toothbrushes to the Chinese who say we can't decouple. You're talking about people who are presumably all about trying to protect our country from this enemy. No?
Absolutely. And I think the something that people have to recognize is the Chinese economy grew at a great rate for a very long time. Why did that happen? Because we were pumping in technology, talent, and capital to build their latent productivity, okay? What's been happening here in the United States for the same amount of time? We have been draining the technology, talent, and capital from this country and not investing at all. So I think one of the things that people like the Raytheon CEO fail to recognize is that as a result of the decline in investment in technology, talent, and capital here in the United States, you have now latent productivity. You have an opportunity to unleash the productive forces of the U.S. economy. And when I hear, you know, like TSMC in Arizona saying Americans are too stupid or lazy to work in their factory, you know, this is something that we've told ourselves. It's become part of this process of deindustrialization. You know, first it was, you know, we can do it cheaper in China. And then it became, well, the reason we can do it cheaper in China is because, you know, Americans want to, you know, are too lazy and they want more money. And then now it's become they're not talented enough to do it. And so these are things, the stories that we tell ourselves to be able to adopt the policies of the past. And I think one of the things that we have to recognize is Americans can do this. They can be productive. They can be hardworking, and they are. And we just have to give them the tools
and
to
frankly,
unleash that
productivity.
And frankly,
we have no choice but to do that.
We have no choice. And furthermore, you know, we have an $800 billion defense budget that by and large, we could retool around this idea of economic productivity and deterrence, which is exactly what Eisenhower set the course for during the first Cold War. So using that part of that budget, using the incredible $42 billion BEAD program that is about building digital infrastructure in the United States, creating the kind of capacity for technology, you know, things like Industry 4.0 and resiliency into our infrastructure, these are the things that's going to get America back to work. And when that happens, when you start to see manufacturing flow back and you start to see automated manufacturing flow back with these technologies like Industry 4.0, you're going to start to see an incredible growth of the American economy. It is just by law of you know, supply and demand and the capacity that has been latent because we've moved all this capacity to China.
In addition to the false narratives that we are telling ourselves and are encouraged to tell ourselves, to be clear, that are unquestionably contributing to the, you know, sort of inertia, shall we say, that is keeping us from doing the sorts of things you've just described, sir. We have this argument that, well, it will just take too long. It's going to, you know, those supply chains can't be severed anytime soon. So we just have to keep doing what we've been doing, which is relying on the Chinese for not just the output of, you know, massive old-fashioned industrial capabilities, steel, for example, but everything from medicines to solar panels. Speak to the timelines here, if you would, Rob, in terms of what it will take to rebuild the capacity in this country to meet those needs, to get the productivity move from latent to once again present.
Well, let's look at the Taiwan situation and say, are we going to continue to remain fully economically coupled if there's an invasion of Taiwan? And if I think most people would say no. Just like, you know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we basically decoupled from Russia. So I think people would say that's probably not going to happen if they invade Taiwan. So what happens then when we do that overnight because of an invasion? So basically, it's going to happen. It's likely to happen. And it's likely to happen on somebody else's timeline, on somebody else's terms. Why not make it be on our timeline, on our terms? So rather than waiting around for the Chinese to invade Taiwan, after which we're going to go ahead and we're just going to decouple, why don't we start the process now? Rather than, you know, listening to every CEO that comes to DC or every, you know, leader of a financial institution that says we can't, and say we must, we have to, it's going to happen.
So there are those who say, well, we've actually begun this process. There's investment is pulling back. You have companies that are, if not onshoring back to this country, at least diversifying their supply chains in India, for example. Some in Vietnam under the theory that that's actually a separate country from China, but I'm not so sure for this purpose that it is. But you're in the thrust of, you're in the midst, I should say, of an effort to put into place a digital infrastructure in this country that is resilient. You're not waiting for us to be taking steps with respect to China and decoupling and all the rest. You're taking the initiative right now. Tell us just a little bit about what you're doing and the impact that you think it might have, maybe, you know, the multiplier effect on other industries as well.
Well, you know, I'll just tell you kind of, and it relates to what I just said, some of the challenges we face are the supply chain. And we have worked diligently to make sure nothing is sourced from China. But every time that we think that we've you know, successfully done that, you know, I'll just give you one example. We had an antenna that was a company is making antennas here in the United States. We're very excited about that. And then one of their antennas in their product line was actually made in China. And so you, and then you see nearly every day that, you know, some part or piece that is supposedly sourced by somebody coming from somewhere else actually is the origin is China. And so we have tremendous difficulty. And that's precisely because of what I'm talking about. You know, yes, we've started the decoupling process, but people like Janet Yellen think that you can somehow, you know, cut some things off and then not cut off other things, and therefore we're going to protect ourselves. And ultimately what the Chinese do, they use those loopholes to basically continue their ties into the supply chain. So, for example, one of the ones they use is, you know, if you move something over the Canadian and the Mexican border that's less than $800, no tariffs. So they get by, they bypass the tariffs by having warehouses on both sides of the border. Then they ship products through a third country like Vietnam, and then it'll stamp made in Vietnam when actually it was made in China. So we can't just decouple from China ourselves. We actually have to create a regime. And this is what I said. We had COCOM during the Cold War, which basically was an alliance, an economic alliance that said we're not going to trade with the Chinese or with the Soviet Union, and nobody that we're going to do business with is going to do it either, because that becomes an avenue for attack. And when so when we have a ally or partner that is not willing to go down this road with us, they become the vector for China's attack. So now Mexico, now Canada, now Vietnam, and many others are the vector that China is using to attack us, even though we've had these tariffs in place for a while. Even though Yellen is going out there and trying to do things, they are figuring out, you know, CFIUS reform, full of loopholes, because corporate America wanted the ability to continue to do things. So there is smart people figuring out how to get by these rules. So when we say that we're decoupling, we're not really, because we're trying to have our cake and eat it too. And what I'm saying, you cannot do that because the Chinese will exploit it.
They will eat your lunch, I think, is the way it works out. Rob Spalding, we have to take a final break. One more break momentarily. We'll be right back right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Former President Donald Trump has been indicted again. This time, he and 18 others have been accused of racketeering for challenging the legitimacy of the 2020 election and seeking redress. At the core of this Trump indictment, among others, is the proposition that those who contend that election was stolen are perpetrating a completely unfounded big lie. Prosecutors are asserting that at least in some instances, the effort to prove otherwise was actually criminal. Yet, new revelations show officials have known for nearly 3 years about evidence of, quote, widespread voter fraud, unquote, in Michigan via an apparently well-organized effort by a Biden-connected group called GBI Strategies. It evidently operated in other states as well. Will the truth about these and many other 2020 election irregularities be on trial, or just the targets of obvious political warfare against Donald Trump and his team? This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We are continuing this very special, very important conversation with General Robert Spalding, United States Air Force retired, the author of Stealth War and War Without Rules. True, tremendously important, and I think very influential books on the subject of, well, the main thing, the Chinese Communist Party, the threat that it represents to us, and what we must do about it. And General, you mentioned, going back again to the Cold War, two entities that I believe had their roots there, certainly the Coordinating Committee on Multilateral Export Controls, the short form of which was COCOM. The other one that is a more recent project of the United States government and still with us, COCOM, alas, is not, but the Committee for Foreign Investment or Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS, are two institutions that I'd like you just to explain a little bit more about. The first was one in which we actually had a veto over our allies and partners' exports of militarily relevant technology to the Soviet Union, and was arguably one of those key elements of the strategy, as you said earlier, for prevailing in that Cold War. It was torn up by the roots by the George H.W. Bush administration when the wall fell. And I've always thought, you know, we need it now more than ever. Talk a little bit about that. And then this entity that is supposed to be looking out for our national security interests in connection with investments from places like China.
Right. So COCOM, so one of the things that you mentioned about is the veto power in COCOM. And I think, so COCOM was dealing with, remember I said, the Chinese have used our technology, talent, and capital to build their economic and military might. Okay. So part of that is exporting technology over. So COCOM dealt with the ability to export technology to the Soviet Union and basically said, you can't. And if you try to, we're going to punish you. If you remember, the Japanese were punished for sending tooling over to Hong Kong that was used to build propellers for submarines, and that was, you know, they got punished for that as part of that COCOM arrangement. So not letting technology flow over there. CFIUS is about not letting U.S. capital, are not letting Chinese money be invested to bring technology over. So that's supposed to stop the technology outflow that, you know, Chinese use to invest in startups here in the U.S. And then finally, the administration just had an investment executive order that said, you know, U.S. companies can't invest in developing technology in China and AI and chips and various other technologies. Now, every one of these has limitations built into the way they were designed, and they were put there by corporate and financial interests in the United States for the purpose of continuing to allow them to do business with the entities in China. So these all have problems. Remember, I said unrestricted warfare requires the first step in doctrine is you have to go defensive. And what you have to do is protect your social, political, cultural, and economic fabric of your society. And so these things are on paper, they're supposed to do that, but they don't actually. They're filled with too many loopholes. So what is the result of this? You know, when I was a defense attaché in Beijing, we had NASA scientists in China teaching them how to build hypersonic missiles. And so Chinese are better in hypersonics. They're better in AI. They just started manufacturing 7-nanometer chips. Now, TSMC, which is the most advanced, is down to 3-nanometer. How long is it going to take the Chinese to really catch up? So they're starting to catch up in all these technologies. Just field a new jet engine for the J-20, right? So they are starting to catch up and then surpass. They surpass us in quantum communications. They're surpassing us in AI. They're going to surpass it. They are surpassing us in hypersonics. I think they're going to surpass us in a lot of these other things. But the protections that we're putting in place are like Swiss cheese in terms of their ability to actually be functional when it comes to defense in an unrestricted warfare world.
But for two reasons. One, that elite capture has given them the support, their old friends, as they put it, in the United States that are working to make sure that any of these defensive measures are Swiss cheese, as you say. And secondly, the cumulative effect of all of those various means. And honestly, I think it may have been money that was coming from China, but I think the capital, as you say, sir, started coming from the United States and was then just routed back to us in the form of purchases of entities right. that would give them access to those technologies. And just right. two prime examples of this, Rob. One is BlackRock, the 800-ton gorilla of Wall Street that has some $10 trillion under management that has been pouring American investors. And by the way, I think you said about the executive order, it was American companies. I think it's all American investors are supposed to not put money into AI or semiconductors or quantum computing in China. But BlackRock certainly has every intention of continuing to do that, as best I can tell, under Larry Fink. We did a very interesting webinar on this subject, by the way, Rob, the other day with many of our Present Danger China committee members. And it's fascinating. And hopefully what the investigation that's now been announced by this new House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party will get to the bottom of what BlackRock has been doing, as well as this index MSCI. But the other piece of this is Sequoia Capital, a guy by the name of Neil Shen, who it turns out is not only a dual citizen, but the guy who has been working directly for the Chinese Politburo, identifying valuable technologies and helping them get the funds and other means to acquire them. When you've got people like this working for the other team, as I say, inside our own wire, it's very problematic that you'll be able actually to prevail, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And this is our big problem. We have to defend first. In an unrestricted warfare world, you cannot go on the offensive until you have protected the social, political, cultural, and economic fabric of your society. You don't do that, you will lose.
You will lose. A breaking point. We're going to have one final interlude, and we will be right back to tie a lot of this up with General Rob Spalding, and especially what we must do now to assure that we protect our society, our culture, our economy, and of course, our security. Stay tuned for that right after this. Welcome back. And once again, we are privileged to be in the company of General Robert Spalding, United States Air Force retired. And we're going to use this final segment to try to sort of synthesize many of the really important points that the general has made in the course of this program and do a little forward looking in particular. General, you have talked about the challenge that we're facing with the Chinese being not only better and better equipped, but having key advantages over us that it seems may well be encouraging them, especially if, as I fear is the case, the commander-in-chief of our military is not just compromised, but captured, as they say. To think that they can move, if not with impunity, at least with acceptable costs, which goes back to what you were saying at the very beginning of this program, which is what's Xi's calculus? How is he thinking about this? What is he intending to do? And knowing that it's hard to be 100% sure of this, based on your knowledge, based on your understanding of the Chinese mentality, is it likely, in your estimation, that the preparations that they clearly have been making to go to war will eventuate in a shooting conflict involving at least Taiwan and maybe us?
Well, I think the first thing they're going to do is they're going to want to make sure that we're not going to be involved in any Taiwan invasion. And that's going to require some blocking measures. And I don't think those are entirely just militarily maintained. In other words, it's not just a blocking measures for our Navy in the Pacific or the Indo-Pacific. It's also blocking measures in terms of throwing sand in the gears for our military mobilization. So this is about planting malware in our networks, in our grid. It's about, being able, it could be about, releasing agents to make our troops sick so that, it's hard to muster and deploy. I mean, there is a whole host of ways. In fact, we employed some of these during the World War II. There was, a nice book of the OSS's dirty tricks that you can use to create problems for the enemy, to throw sand in the gears. There's a lot more ability now with a globalized internet and globalization to be able to get in and to do those type of things. Then there's things like EMP, a single EMP in the right place over the United States creates a catastrophic failure of the grid. Or the fact that
electromagnetic pulse,
and
generally we get disputes about that from the electric utilities. Is you're a serious professional in this space? Is there any doubt in your mind that that would be the effect?
No, not at all. I mean, it's been proven that this is a challenge for things that aren't hardened. There's certain things like your smartphone that'll survive quite well. We've tested them. What doesn't survive is the infrastructure it needs to connect to, and so hardening our networks. Harden our grid is something that we have to do. I mean, if you remember what happened after Hurricane Katrina, I mean, it was chaos when you lose the things that allow you to communicate and operate for any period of time. And think about that for a significant period of time in the United States. One of the things that I was always frustrated with after looking at Katrina is I had the best comm system in the world in terms of the ability to withstand attack and keep going. And I was a B-2 pilot that flew nuclear, armed weapons, which meant that we had to always be in connection to the president, no matter what. And so we built systems to do that. Well, what happens to my family? What happens to our communities, our collective communities, when all the communication except the nuclear forces go away? And this is why I started this company, to really focus on the fact that the society is going to need to be protected against the potential for these types of attacks.
And that is precisely what Semper is doing, is to try to prevent, EMP is your middle name, I guess you might say, a resiliency against those effects for digital communications. Is that right?
That's right. And it's not just for EMP. I mean, we're highly centralized. If you remember, two Christmases ago, some crazy man blew up the AT&T switching center in Nashville, took down telecommunications in Tennessee and surrounding states for several weeks. This is because we built these highly centralized systems that are not hardened against attack. So it can be an EMP, but it can be just a crazy man blowing something up that's, it's in a centralized place. We have very few major data centers. We have very few data centers that operate our cell networks. And so that allows us to have very few targets to go after. And so what we believe is that you need to be distributed. You need to have a lot of capability locally that allows you to continue to operate, even if those centralized places are taken out. And that's what Semper is about, is creating resiliency throughout our infrastructure, not taking it away or changing it wholesale, but just providing resiliency in those areas where we feel it's important to keep communities going.
Absolutely vital. And General, just two quick things that it doesn't necessarily require a crazy man to want to take down those critical nodes, especially if, as we're now having reported, and there's, I think, growing evidence of it, the Chinese are insinuating large numbers of
thousands,
what appear to be People's Liberation Army operatives inside the country. And you know, you talk about the OSS's dirty tricks. I'm sure they've read the book and have come up with a lot of adaptations.
Yeah, and this is in spite of the fact there's an exit ban in China.
Right. Yeah.
You cannot leave China without the Communist Party's express
permission.
Approval.
Yeah. Right. And so if you happen to be a military age young man
to Latin America and then coming across the southern border.
Yeah, not an accident.
They have to have the Chinese Communist Party's permission.
I have to ask you 30 seconds worth of answer. You touched on the possibility that people might want to make our military sick. The Reedley Laboratory, which seemed to be at least a biowarfare capable facility, secret in the heart of an American city in California, would seem to be the kind of thing that might help do that, don't you think?
Or the great thing about China is that you never know. And sometimes things have dual purposes. You know, it may be just a person trying to make money, but then the Communist Party is helping them do that because they have ulterior motives for that capability later on. That's the beauty of unrestricted warfare. You can have one thing be for one reason, but then have a half dozen other reasons that you use it for.
I have to wrap. General, how do people find more about Semper?
Go to our website, Semper, SEMPRE.AI.
Thank you, General Robert Spalding, for your service to our country, especially that you are continuing to perform today at Semper. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.